What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. It's early in this NBA season, but we've already got plenty of drama and weirdness across the league, mostly with the super teams, it seems like. The Lakers have had some infighting. We've got a Russ Westbrook ejection, the collapse against the Thunder. The Nets look like, wobbly would be a word. James Harden seems like a shell of himself at the moment. Kyrie and Ben Simmons are still MIA. We don't even need to deal with them. But not to be overlooked amid all of this, the Dallas Mavericks, who I think might do drama and intrigue better than any team not named Lakers or Knicks. They've got a new coach, Jason Kidd. They've got a new front office, an MVP candidate, a second star who might not be a star and can't stay healthy. Oh, and they have a leadership council. That's nifty. And it's making rotation decisions. Here to help explain all of that is the excellent Mavericks reporter for The Athletic, Tim Cato. We will dive into all the weirdness. Before we get to that, a quick reminder to please rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Check us out on the YouTube feed as well. Search for Sports Illustrated Podcasts. You will find this podcast and all the other great SI pods there. Oh, and Chris Mannix and I have a really fun new video feature also on YouTube. It's called Order on the Court. We pick a topic, we make our cases, and you, the viewer, decide the winner. So please go check that out as well. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, unpacking the drama-rich Mavericks with Tim Cato is coming up next. So stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by the excellent beat writer covering the Dallas Mavericks for The Athletic, Tim Cato. Tim, welcome. How are you, sir?
Howard, how are you? I'm doing superb. So hopefully the same to you.
Yes, thank you. It's been a long time since we've seen each other in person. It's been a long time since I've seen anybody in person, frankly. I finally went to a Nets game last night. And it was this strange experience of like being both familiar and weird. But it was just great to see a bunch of beat writers and some team personnel and be back in arenas again and down on the floor. And it feels almost normal.
The moment that got me was seeing some of the same security guards and some of the same arena staffers that, you know, I know their names, always say, you know, nice things to when I'm at the arena. But, you know, just have no relationship outside of the context of the arena. And we haven't been there in, you know, damn near 18 months. And so that I don't know, there's just something so wholesome and just sweet about that to see these people again and be like,
the same experience. There's a woman who's always posted right outside the media dining and media workroom in Brooklyn. But we've both got our masks on. And so I had to kind of like hesitate for a second. I'm like, oh yeah. And then I wanted to like, she's very friendly. We always smile at each other. So now I know we're both smiling. I know I am. I'm pretty sure she is. But we have our masks on by NBA edict, of course. But still, it was like wonderful to see her. Like, oh, hey, how are you? It's been, like almost 2 years or something.
It's a good feeling, man. So it's a great feeling.
It is. It's just great being back in NBA arenas and with the ability to actually talk to people and not just stuck in the third deck waiting for a Zoom to open.
Exactly.
So wanted to bring you on because, your Mavericks, yes, I'm giving them to you. when you cover them,
I don't know if Mark Cuban would be so okay with that, but, I'll take it.
Mark Cuban's Mavericks. I feel like this team does not get enough credit for like the drama it produces, like outside of maybe the Lakers and the Knicks, the Mavericks might be the most consistent source, in the NBA. They do it pretty well. They've already had an interesting, opening week and a half or so here under Jason Kidd as their first year coach, and they've got a new GM and they've got a leadership council. As soon as I saw the words leadership council, I thought I need to bring Tim on the podcast. I got to find like there's a leadership council. That alone would be enough to pod about. But I want to start with this because this was your lead on Wednesday coming off of the Tuesday night victory over the Rockets. And you said, quote, This is what you wrote. Quote, 3 games into the Dallas Mavericks, Jason Kidera, I'm comfortable saying, we'll always have something to talk about. True enough. So we have, let's just run down real quickly. We've got Luka, of course, who's a phenomenon and a future MVP, maybe even a this season MVP. We can get into that. We've got Porzingis, this would-be second star who may be the key to the title or the reason they'll never make the finals. Cuban, of course, always has something to say, tweet, reality TV star, may or may not run for president. Drama, of course, you and Sam Amick had that incredible deep dive into all the politics of the Mavericks that eventually led to Donnie Nelson being out after 20-ish years as GM and Rick Carlisle's gone after 13 years. There was the Bob Vulgaris angle to all that. New GM Nico Harrison, new coach Jason Kidd, who has drama everywhere he goes. And maybe they're a contender in the West? I don't know. Maybe. So there's all that. How's that to start a season? So let's start here, though. Tuesday night, Mark Cuban's Dallas Mavericks, your Dallas Mavericks, used all 15 players, which, as you note, might have been a first.
It was. Basketball Reference DM'd me to confirm that it's the first time in their database that's happened. And there's only been like a year and a week that they've actually expanded the rosters of 15, of course, but it is the first time that all 15 players, that 15 NBA players have appeared through three quarters, according to a Basketball Reference DM to me.
This is a great and historic moment, and if Mavericks fans were as creative as Knicks fans, there would have already been a fake banner created noting first team ever to use 15 players and hang it in the rafters. So Mavericks fans, if you're listening, get on that. Knicks fans are really good at this, and it's a wonderful Twitter meme. All 15 players, even Josh Green and Frank Ntilikina. And they did it for this reason, because Jason Kidd said the leadership council wanted it. The leadership council, as I understand it from your story, is Luka, Kristaps Porzingis, and Tim Hardaway Jr. I have questions. I have curiosities. What are the powers of this leadership council? How often do they meet? Do they follow Robert's rules of order? What else do they get to decide? Apparently, they also anointed Dwight Powell as a starter in the preseason. This is a powerful council. Tell me about the council.
I think we're still in many ways investigating just how much power they have. But it's an amusing thing. You know, it definitely contributed to the idea that there's always going to be something to talk about. I guess what I would say is that the idea of a coach listening to his players is not unusual. The idea that star players, and those are the three star players on the Mavericks, Kristaps, Luka, and Tim Hardaway Jr. The idea of, you know, those three players having ideas and a coaching staff listening to them, I don't think that's unusual, and I think that's the case throughout a lot of teams. What we've seen with Jason Kidd coming in is that Rick Carlisle ran things very differently, and Mark Cuban, following their Game 7 loss to the Clippers just a few months ago, immediately came out in support of Carlisle. Now, Carlisle chose to leave, but I think you can infer from all that is that, you know, Mark Cuban viewed Rick as, in his philosophy, in his style, the way he was coaching the team, he viewed the on-court stuff as being right and being accurate. So Jason Kidd is not in here. Like, he definitely has some tweaks that he's making to what the team's doing on offense and defense. We can talk about that here in a little bit. But, you know, with Jason Kidd coming in, I think what he's really trying to do is, you know, look at a team that doesn't need massive overhauls. And also, and this is, I think, an indictment, it's a team that the roster hasn't really changed in 3 years. There's not really massive overhauls that he can do. So what he is trying to do is seriously overwrite the culture that existed under Carlisle, where Carlisle was... he was many things, and certainly an abrasive personality, certainly a stern one and a strict one. That is kind of the way he ran the team. So if you bring in a head coach and the on-court stuff isn't going to change that much, one of the ways that you can change things is really lean into chemistry and really lean into the culture around the team. So to me, you know, even though, you know, another coach might not tell us about this leadership council, a leadership council of sorts may exist on other teams without the name itself. Apparently there are actually going to be weekly meetings between these three and Jason Kidd. So there is a bit of structure, a corporate structure to it. But to me, a lot of it just stems around the idea of rewriting the culture that existed in the Mavericks, making it much more player-friendly, And just having a coach, Jason Kidd, that, you know, we've certainly heard stories from his previous coaching tenures where he did lean into very aggressive styles of coaching, too aggressive, I would say, in certain anecdotes that have been published. But I think his day-to-day demeanor is much calmer and much friendlier, much more player-friendly. And I think that's the side of himself as a coach that it's very clear he's leaning into, and this is a representation of that.
So that part is fascinating, Tim, because we know how this goes, not just in the NBA, but in all professional sports. If you have a strict disciplinarian type and things go south, you replace him with the player-friendly coach. And if the player-friendly coach everybody deems as being too soft on the players and things have gotten too loose, you snap back. It's always this pendulum snapping back and forth between the two. Not always, but very common. When they made this change, when Rick left and they hired Jason Kidd, my thought was, well, aside from all of Kidd's, you know, kind of messiness in Brooklyn and Milwaukee, there was the fact that Jason's old school. He's as old school as they get. He was as a player, and he seemed to certainly be as a coach. I wrote a story about Jason 3 years ago, a little while after he'd been fired by the Bucks. We sat down and we talked about everything that had gone right and wrong in Milwaukee and Brooklyn. And I was pretty direct with a lot of, you know, listen, Jason, this is what people have been saying about the way you coached and the way you handled these players. And he didn't shy away from any of it, but he also was totally unrepentant. He didn't exactly, like the thing you'd normally expect when somebody agrees to an interview like that is they're going to say, you know what, I messed up, I'm going to learn from it, I'm going to be a better coach, I'm going to, in the next job, I'm going to whatever, because that's what he was trying to do, of course, is polish his image a little bit for the next job. As it turns out, he didn't work the next season, then he spent the 2 years as an assistant on the Laker bench. It took a while before he got another opportunity, and it took Mark Cuban, who he has a personal relationship with, to get that lifeline. But the lack of what I thought was a lack of self-awareness and self-reflection or willingness to embrace some of the criticism, I thought might keep him from getting another opportunity at that time. What you're telling me now, Tim, does sound like Jason Kidd has evolved a little in his approach, because being abrasive and over-aggressive with his players, whatever, the things that you describe of Carlisle, I think is not dissimilar from what Kidd was said to be with the Bucks and what wore out his welcome there. So are you perceiving that there is an evolution that's happened here?
Yeah, you said the interview you did with him was 3 years ago, so that would have been 2018?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I would say that it does seem he has evolved. There were people who told me that he did view the Lakers, the 2 years as the Lakers assistant coach. He viewed that as a necessary step back for him. And I think some of the things he said about what he learned during his time there is a more introspective, reflective, you know, just look at how he should be handling players and how he should go about approaching player relationships. So I do think that he has had some growth as a coach in the 2 years that he spent, you know, in Los Angeles. I also think that a large, you know, he was hired with the understanding that he would, you know, kind of be this as well. And I think the relationship the decade plus relationship he's now had with Mark Cuban is a huge factor to that. I mean, I don't know everything that goes into that, but you know, I do think it's clear to me that Cuban understands that this is someone who isn't going to come in and try to undermine power or claim power that, you know, is unclaimed in the way that Jason did in Brooklyn and in Milwaukee, which has been reported, you know, extensively in both stops. I think that there's a clear understanding between these two men that something like that isn't going to happen. The reason that at least that Mark trusts that is that, you know, it has to do with this relationship he's had with this person. So yes, I do think that he is approaching this head coaching job and gig differently than he had or did the previous two. And I think that's probably the biggest difference in terms of, you know, just how he's conducting things in Dallas.
So we are recording this a few hours before their fourth game. So we have a microscopically small sample size to analyze at the moment, which is dangerous and stupid. But I've never been accused of being smart about my NBA analysis. So I don't want to draw too much out of it, but I mean, listen, you've got a few games of preseason and a few games now of regular season. For what it's worth, they're right now ranking 12th in defensive efficiency, 25th in offensive efficiency. That's kind of an inverse of where they were under Carlisle last year. Do you see anything in the profile of the way they're playing offensively, defensively, that is giving an indication of what the Jason Kidd way will be that's different than the Carlisle way? We tend to reduce these teams to just, well, if you got Luka, doesn't matter who's coaching him, you're going to play a certain way because that's how the best to maximize Luka. As you noted, the roster really hasn't changed much, which I think is kind of an indictment of the franchise over the last few years, frankly. Maybe a good reason to overhaul the front office, too.
Strong agree here.
Yeah. So good reason to change the front office. I think things had gotten stale there. We can talk about that too. But what does a Jason Kidd Mavericks team look like so far that's different than a Rick Carlisle Mavericks team?
Yeah, let's tackle them both. Starting offense, I think that it's clear that, you know, in the preseason there's a lot of comments about Luka trusting his teammates more, about more movement, about things like that. I think we saw in Atlanta, which was their season opener, they lost fairly handily. Some of these ideas of movement really brought around terrible spacing. We saw a lot of examples of that floating around Twitter. And then I think even against Toronto, their second game, which they did win, there was more examples of that. But we also saw in the second half that they reverted more to a Carlisle style. Better spacing, more single big lineups and five out lineups. And, you know, if you are going to have a rolling big on the floor like Dwight Powell, he's going to be the only guy on there and really an emphasis on that. I think broadly what the team's trying to do, what the logic behind the changes has been that if you're not going to have the shot creation that this team really needs, and will probably continue to be an issue if they head into the postseason once again with, you know, only Luka and Jalen Brunson as their primary creators, one of the ways you can at least try to mitigate that a little bit is to build in more motion, more movement, more cutting. I do think that, you know, they've talked a lot about Kristaps and that he's going to get more post-ups and things like that. I still think that's important to a degree. You know, they need to be the right type of post-ups, but, you know, Kristaps clearly didn't jive or resonate well with Carlisle. And so I think some of this is building up the confidence and relationship of, you know, and trust that Porzingis has in the franchise with a new head coach here. And some of it is continuing to try to, you know, unlock the best version of Kristaps that they can, because I think that is something that's going to be important in the postseason. I think in their third game, and again, super small sample size, and, you know, we're just dealing with, you know, this is all eye test stuff. Like, we haven't even, you know, the stats aren't something that we can even really bring up in a meaningful way. But from the eye test, you know, there wasn't a lot of called post-ups for Kristaps. There was a lot better spacing. Some of the spacing concerns where Kristaps and Dwight Powell were both somewhat aimlessly floating below the three-point line in the season opener, I didn't really see much of that. I thought execution-wise, it was a pretty effective game against Houston. If you can continue building in some of these ideas, and a lot of them are coming from assistant coach Igor Kokoskov, he coached Luka with the Slovenian national team in their Euro Cup run, Euro Basket, I believe is the one. I always mix those up. That was 2017, and then of course he was in Phoenix for a bit. A lot of the offensive ideas are coming from him, but I think, you know, clearly this is something that Kidd believes is a good idea broadly. So, you know, the idea is not to take the ball out of Luka's hands. Last I checked, he's still averaging 99, you know, this might have been before the Houston game, but he was averaging, you know, like 98 touches, third most in the league. So the idea that Luka's going to have the ball less is not actually what this is coming from. The idea is that he's more willing to give it up to teammates and if needed get it back and just avoid him, like, kind of reverting into the worst tendencies James Harden had in the tail years with the Rockets. Like, I think that's what they're trying to avoid. And they're trying to build an offense that he is able to, you know, that is able to create some shot creation just through system and movement and cutting and things like that. So I think offensively, more or less, yeah, if you have any thoughts on that, I'm happy to hear them or questions, or if not, I can jump to defense.
No, I mean, let's stay with offense for a minute, because I thought, you know, this, obviously the Mavericks were one of the teams that had cleared the decks in the event that they might be able to chase Giannis. And so it was going to be a cap room kind of offseason for them. And then, of course, Giannis had re-upped before the season, takes everybody out of the mix. But I thought the Mavericks, having set themselves up to, you know, be in free agency, and I know there are some limitations there, I thought they'd be chasing the Kyle Lowrys and Spencer Dinwiddie's and other point guards, Lonzo Ball, who knows. We've heard the Dragic rumors, and maybe that's going to come back around, depending on what happens in Toronto in the next couple months.
Last night, Dragic.
Yeah.
The only Raptor who didn't, so.
So maybe they're already setting it up. I mean, you mentioned shot creation, and this has seemed like the obvious thing since Luka arrived, was like, this kid is amazing, and he can do a ton with the ball in his hands. But as you said, and I was a skeptic of the Harden Rockets philosophy his whole time there, that I think there's diminishing returns, or at least a limit on how far you can get when you just place that much, that high a usage rate in one player's hands and count them to do everything all the time, and it can wear them out. Porzingis is not your typical second star. I'm not even sure we should call him a star right now. So you don't have that. So at minimum, I would think you'd want another ball handler, shot creator type coming off the bench or even playing alongside Luka. Where did that go? Like, how aggressively did the Mavericks even go down that road? Is there still a potential fix in season? How important do you think that they believe it is, as opposed to how important you and I might believe it is?
It was the stated idea for the team. I mean, Mark Cuban said that's one of the things they wanted to acquire in the offseason, you know, a month before free agency opened or something like that. And then they just didn't do it. They did pursue Lowry. He was their number one target, as, you know, as reporting, you know, it was reported he was their top target. He just was, you know, Lowry was always focused on Miami once that became an option. They did try to pivot to Dragic. That fell through for unclear reasons, I would say. You know, I've heard various things. Other things have been reported. I think that they didn't, you know, they felt like they didn't need to send what Toronto was asking because he would be available cheaper at a later point. And that still, you know, that gamble may still ring true. I think someone like Dragic would help a bit. Obviously, he is a 35-year-old who is declining. He's not a, you know, just cure-all by any means. But it's clear that they need shot creation. It's clear that Luka and Brunson alone, and Brunson's going to play like 28, 30 minutes a night. He's been averaging that through three, and they really have no other option. He's a really solid player, but he's also a player who thrives on very small amounts of space. He's very good at manipulating those levels of space. And I think that is one of the reasons that he has struggled. He didn't play two postseasons ago. He was out with a shoulder injury, but last... you know, his playoff debut against the Clippers went fairly poorly. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, space gets even shorter and smaller and harder to come by. And especially if you're a player who's already dealing with, you know, micro levels of space. And that's where, you know, he is very effective. I think it does make it more difficult on them. So I think the Mavericks are set up to win a lot of regular season games. Even if they experiment with, you know, some different offensive strategies and ideas that might help them long term, I still think that they have such a high baseline of just running Luka pick and rolls on a five out floor that, you know, they can always revert to that. They will definitely be able to win games doing that. But yeah, they're still, you know, they still have the same concerns headed into the postseason, is that, you know, it's a combination of Luka and just asking everything on offense of one player. That's going to remain an issue if they head into the postseason doing that. We also saw that Luka was being asked to do so much against the Clippers that he was wearing down headed into the second halves and fourth quarters. And so I do think it's crucial to continue trying to get a shot creator of some sort. And it's baffling to me that they haven't had more success being able to do it. I mean, just think back to 2019. They traded Harrison Barnes right after the Porzingis trade. And the Barnes trade was supposed to clear cap and set them up for that summer or even the following summer where they could make a free agency splash. And, you know, they tried with DeLon Wright and Josh Richardson, and they were like, maybe we can bring in like a sort of shot creator, like a secondary shot creator, and that will be enough. And it just didn't work. It, you know, with both players, it very clearly did not work. And so, yeah, I think what this team clearly needs is a... You know, whether it's a second star or, you know, just a player like Dragic, but a few years younger or something like that. They just need somebody who can create you know, that isn't Luka, and they just really don't have that right now, and that's going to be the flaw headed into the postseason.
And I don't know what their path is, Tim. Like, I don't, like, if it wasn't going to be in free agency, now you're in season, so now you're talking about trade market, or, you know, maybe buyout market. There's always that possibility too, but right. It's not like they got a lot of movable pieces or any great assets to swap out. I mean, I'm not even sure where that path is. Now, if it's somebody like Dragic, who's kind of a, you know, older player, not, you know, the value isn't as high, you can, you know, whatever, maybe you're getting him for a couple of seconds and a, you know, whatever, somebody off your end of your bench. I don't know. But I don't see a route to a really solid and more prolonged option as a secondary shot creator. So right. We don't have to get deep into trade market stuff, but I mean, that part would concern me.
It seems they really, really doubled down on free agency being the path forwards. And to their credit, if you're going to double down on that, at least go get a general manager who, you know, Nico Harrison, it's clear that his immediately transferable skills is the relationships he's able to build with stars. I think Michael Finley being the number two in that front office is also helpful to that regard, much more than a Donnie Nelson. But the way they just have absolutely doubled down on that over the past few years is confusing to me. Major stars don't move through free agency anymore. It's always trades at this point, you know, because of the player empowerment era, they're able to ask out with enough time remaining on their contracts. They're not going to reach free agency. And almost every front office has wisened up to the fact that they need to get value back. This is a team that, you know, doesn't have many first round picks. They don't own anybody else's first round picks. They really don't have any prospects that are, you know, intriguing to hardly anyone. You know, they have very fringe prospects. So I agree. The way that they've doubled down on this is both frustrating and confusing, I think, from, you know, someone who's been analyzing this team for years. And I think that's a big flaw in their thinking. And I think a lot of it does go back to Mark Cuban believing that, you know, just the power of himself, the Mavericks brand, the championship, you know, like think back to after they did win in 2011.
Yeah.
They pretty much gutted that title team thinking, you know, that they had a deal worked out with an agent that Dwight Howard and Darren Williams were going to team up in Dallas, and they're just going to clear cap space, and that's all it was going to take. Yeah. And they realized over time that, you know, an aging Dirk Nowitzki in cap space is not enough to sign free agents, star free agents that, you know, 28 other teams would love to have. And so I think it's been a miscalculation in a lot of ways over time. And, you know, especially, and then I talked about, you know, they traded Barnes, they cleared cap space. They didn't even go get that mid-tier guy who is tradable, you know, whether it's a Bogdanovich that Atlanta ended up grabbing. You know, at least Bogdanovich is a player that, you know, maybe not for, you know, if Karl Anthony Towns asked out, just hypothetical, don't get mad at me, Minnesota fans, hypothetically, just like throwing it out as a potential person, you know, let's say he asked out. At least if you had some mid-tier players, that could, you know, massage a sort of deal that's a little bit lacking in terms of, you know, star prospects, and it doesn't quite have as many first round picks as you would like. They don't really have those players. So we could talk another hour about how in many ways it's just very confusing what they've done. And even what's funny is even some of the process correct things that I think were smart or did make sense, even some of those have backfired. And, you know, it's a tricky situation, and Luka Doncic does smooth over a lot of missteps. But eventually you do need to get, you know, another shot creator, another high-level scorer who can, you know, actually do stuff that isn't predicated on Luka.
Yeah. No, well said. And yes, I was thinking of the wake of the 2011 championship and how they had gone all in on, we're going to let everybody go. Tyson goes, Jason goes, everybody. And we're going to be in free agency. And we've got the smarter plan. Everybody, you know, the new structure that coming out of the lockout and the CBA, the new CBA was going to hamstring everybody else, but we're going to be the ones who are, yeah, it didn't work. And then
they thought they were smarter than everyone else. They really did.
And they've been continuing on that course ever since and never really course correcting. And just as Luka papers over a lot of issues, Dirk was papering over a lot of issues for a long time. And so like they look great as a franchise overall because you got two generational talents, and kudos to trading for the draft rights to both of those guys and being the ones smart enough to do it. But everything they've done around each of them, the championship year notwithstanding, has been, you know, pretty scattered, wobbly. I don't know. I need a better adjective. But it has not been great, draft-wise, free agency-wise, anything else in surrounding them. So which brings us to Kristaps Porzingis. You don't generally contend in this league without two all-stars, sometimes three. And if it's just one, then you better have a really, really high-level supporting cast overall across the board. The optimist view of Kristaps Porzingis coming into this season was, hey, full offseason with no surgeries or anything to deal with, so he can train and he'll come back in great shape, and that will solve everything because, hey, the numbers have been decent when he's played. It's more just, can he stay on the court long enough? Is the mobility there, especially defensively? And here we are, you're going into, as I say, we're recording a few hours before game four of their season, and he's out with a back issue. I don't even know where to begin, but I mean, I guess is there any reason to believe at this stage, and he's still on the younger side, but that Porzingis can be that second star that you need next to Luka? And if he's not, I mean, there's a really massive then what comes behind that.
Right. I think a little bit of the Kristaps talk is so framed around his Clippers series and the, you know, everybody laughing and pointing at him. Oh, he's just a corner three-point shooter now. He did average 20 points last season, and it was on career efficiency. He's certainly someone who can score, and he's a very useful player to have. I think he's the key, you know, probably the biggest influence to their spacing. Honestly, he should, for his reputation, he does not hit as many shots as you would think. He shoots about the same on wide open shots as he does contested shots. But something about him, he's one of those players, I think Marcus Smart is another example, where defenders gravitate towards him more than his percentages would suggest. There's something about a 7'3 guy who shoots, you know, who has the mechanics and the look of a shooter like Porzingis, that really just strikes fear in people. And so he really is a crucial part to the spacing. I think in terms of a shot creator, I think you just have to move on from that idea. He's not going to be that, you know, he's not a, you know, if you can get some mismatch post-ups on, you know, that he's going to convert fairly efficiently, I think that's great. I think that's important for the team as they head into the postseason. A big reason why he wasn't able to do that or wasn't doing that against the Clippers is because the Clippers decided they were going to play Kawhi Leonard on him. And at that point, you know, you don't want anyone trying to score against Kawhi Leonard. So at that point, it did make sense for him to be a corner post up or corner 3-point threat. But, you know, I thought that was sound defensively, and it was also like very unique to that series and that setting. And I think a team like the Clippers was one of the very few that was able to do that against him. He can be a useful player, and as long as, you know, he's shot terribly through three games, but the injury is supposed to be minor and the numbers are going to revert. Like he's way well below his career numbers. Like he's going to hit some shots. I think that if he can be a spacing threat, if he can be an occasional shot creator in mismatch scenarios, not someone you're going to run offense through or need to call a lot of plays for, I think that that's still a really valuable offensive player. And the ceiling that the way he really impacts the Mavericks' ceilings is defensively. You asked me what Kidd was doing earlier, and we stuck with the offense for a bit. What Kidd's doing differently defensively really is just more movement, more defensive movement. Last year, Carlisle, you know, tended to run it. His pick and roll schemes were either really passive drop coverage with Porzingis, you know, barely coming out of the paint, or they would do fairly passive switching as well, where, you know, they just concede in mismatches. And I think, you know, I don't know how much of that was Carlisle and the way he wanted to play or just the way he was forced to play with Porzingis because Porzingis was moving so poorly. The one good thing that we've seen so far this season is that Porzingis does seem to have a lot of his mobility back. You know, all of the storylines this summer about him, you know, finally having a season without having to rehab and all this, it does seem to really affect him in terms of athleticism and mobility. He looks great. And I think that, to me, is, at this point, the type of player he is, that is way more important than him, you know, shooting 42% versus 37% on threes. Like, sure, you definitely want him to shoot more and make more, but I think what he is as a spacer and what he is as an offensive player, you know, the best version of what he's realistically going to be this season and the worst version of what he's realistically going to be this season on offense doesn't matter that much as compared to him being a mobile defensive threat who's really a rim protector again, isn't someone who's just going to be, you know, complete toast anytime he's isolated on a mismatch against a smaller player, and just is someone that you can actually build a defensive structure around. And that's what Kidd's trying to do with more movement, with a little bit more helping, with having Kristaps come higher on pick and rolls. And so far, I think it's looked very effective. I think you mentioned it earlier. There's something like 12th defensively. Again, three games. But just from the eye test, I think that the defense looks like it's in a better place. And a lot of that has to do with the way Porzingis looks.
It's interesting because, you know, when he was dubbed the unicorn by Kevin Durant when he was early in his Knicks career, the things that stuck out about Porzingis in terms of what made him so unique was, here's a guy who his last season in New York before the knee injury, he was averaging nearly 2.5 blocks a game. And at that time, I think more like, you know, 1.5 threes a game. But in Dallas, he's averaged about 2.5 threes a game. So this is a guy who's capable of averaging at his best 2.5 blocks, 2.5 threes. There aren't many guys who have been built like that in the history of this game, even though it's becoming more common now. You know, Miles Turner does a little of both, and Serge Ibaka in his prime was doing both those. Like, that's a really great combination to have in a big man. Stretch the defense at one end, be a rim protector at the other. So that alone could make him very valuable for them. But this is obviously, you know, a pick and roll league, and you've got to be able to guard away from the basket, and you got to be able to move. And so, yeah, I mean, if he's moving better and when the back thing works out, like, you know, maybe we'll see more of that balanced version of Porzingis. The glass half full thing here statistically, Tim, and I noted this a couple times last season. So he averaged 20 points, 8.9 rebounds, and 1.3 blocks. The only other guys in the league who averaged 28 and at least a block last season were Joel Embiid, who was an MVP candidate, Giannis, who was an MVP candidate, Karl-Anthony Towns, who's Karl-Anthony Towns, and Christian Wood. If you add in the 2 3-pointers per game, that list drops down to just Porzingis and Karl-Anthony Towns. There is a unique profile here, and it may not be good enough to be the second star on a championship team. I don't know. The raw numbers suggest that there's a really valuable quantity there in some sort of package. And then I feel like the defense is the rest of it.
He's a max player.
The problem is he's a max player.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like that list you've listed, he's like, he can be a Christian Wood type player, but Christian Wood isn't making max money. That's inherently the issue. It's both the expectations that come with the max contract and then just like the actual cap sheet. If you're allocating that percentage of your cap to a player like that, even though he can be highly useful, highly impactful on both ends, if this defensive stuff sticks around and holds, that's the issue.
He'll probably still be overpaid. And, you know, but look, that's common in this league. There's a lot of guys who are paid more than their actual value if you run the numbers, whatever. But it's why I asked earlier, like, if he's not their second star, then who is? Because he's making second star money, and it's hard to fit another max deal on there. He's probably not all that easy to trade at this stage. Making $31.6 million this season, $33.8 million next season, and then he has a $36 million option in 2023-24. I've always said there's no question in my mind, like, on the basic fundamentals of the trade, the Mavericks won the trade. They got not just the best player, they got also Tim Hardaway Jr., who's a core player for them. So they got two really good players.
Yeah, the best player.
They got the two best players. Exactly. They got Tim Hardaway Jr., the best player.
You could make
deal.
That argument.
You can. Yeah. It's a fair argument. But they sent out DeAndre Jordan, who, you know, barely played for the Knicks or did not play. Wes Matthews, who barely played or did not play. Dennis Smith Jr., who washed out. And two firsts, which so far have proved to be, I think, probably nominal. We'll see. And we knew they were going to be low. So it wasn't like a big price to pay for a 24-year-old recent All-Star at the time, even if he was coming off the ACL. The deal itself is fine. It's always the extension that is the problem. There's nothing wrong with the trade if you could have avoided not maxing him out. That seemed to be sort of baked in or implied. I know that, but like, negotiations are a different thing. I don't want to ever assume anything. Bottom line is, he's there. I guess I could ask you, is there any sense that they regret the trade? But maybe it's more of like, do they regret the long-term commitment more so than the trade? Because again, they didn't give up much to get him and Tim Hardaway.
Right. Yeah, I think just looking at what, you know, each team traded is the wrong way to look at that trade. Clearly from that perspective, the Mavericks got more value back. The question is whether, and they traded knowing they were going to commit to Porzingis on a on that extension. He didn't play with them. You know, they got to see him in practice and stuff, but he didn't play a game before they signed him to that extension following the trade. The big question is whether that was the right swing to make. And when you look at the value they got back, it's still kind of easy to argue, like, of course you should take that level of value back. But it was also a gamble. And you know, we've seen it. We've seen a team like Atlanta that had also drafted their star player, their franchise player in the same draft as Luka. And, you know, whatever we think of that, that's not for this
that's a whole other podcast.
Exactly. and then they built methodically around Trey. They did have more picks, and they did have more ability to, but they also didn't make their game changing move. And they had another, you know, lottery selection, a couple more lottery selections they were able to make to build up the roster before really, you know, joining playoff contention and then making that conference finals run that they did. And I think that's the debate. And I think, it's tough. Like, I think Luka was ready. Luka was ready to win. It was very clear that when they made the Kristaps trade, that Luka was already becoming too good, that it would have been very hard to stay out of the playoffs even if they didn't make a trade like that. And that is like, he almost got too good too fast. Like, I mean, it's a weird thing to complain about, but it's kind of true. And so, yeah, in some ways they were put in a tight situation where, you know, they didn't have the 3 or 4 year building process of compiling assets, compiling draft picks, compiling young players. And again, even if those young players don't, you know, pan out in terms of they're going to fit right into your rotation or your starting lineup, that also gives you ammunition to go trade for someone else, you know, if that situation arises. And they didn't really have that. And so they immediately swung for Porzingis. And I think the question, like I said, is not whether they got more value back, but whether that was the move they should have made. That was the win now move. They were, you know, it was the right time to make that one. And for that player, for that haul coming back to them. And I don't have an answer. Like, that's so tough. Like, I understand why they did it. I completely understand why they did it. And I completely understand that Luka being so good so fast put them in a bad situation in terms of a slightly slower build up to being a contending team. But the reality is that now they're looking ahead to the next few years and they have very little to trade for, very little, you know, basically no draft capital that's going to add meaningful talents unless they really hit on somebody. In the post 20, you know, in the 20s and the 30s, and really their only option is free agency. Like we were saying earlier, it's such a commitment that is both their decision, their choice to a big degree, but also just kind of the way this all played out. So, I mean, I guess they will have cap space eventually. I think 2023 they should have some level of cap space. I think that if especially if they look to trade Porzingis, like, they should be able to clear max cap space. So I guess that's what they're looking for ahead to. And, you know, just seeing how good they can maximize this team and this roster right now, given that Luka sets the floor so high for you. But yeah, it's a really curious case to examine just kind of how they went about this, because I think it's a combination of mistakes they made and priorities they had wrong, but also just kind of the way the NBA works. And they were kind of put in bad situations to some degree, just by the way everything kind of broke.
Well, we know this much. There are no untradeable contracts in this league. Every time we deem somebody untradeable, they get traded, sometimes multiple times. Hello, Russell Westbrook. And John Wall got dealt, and Chris Paul's deal at one point was supposed to be untradeable and all that. So there's always a market. It's always the real question. The trick is, what are you getting back? And are you getting anything valuable back? I think maybe their best path forward, if it's getting a second star, is, you know, tamper like crazy, because that's what everybody does anyway. And if you know somebody's coming, you trade Porzingis in a pure salary dump, get back nominal whatever, just so you can get him off the books because you know star number two is coming. Or at least you think you know. Of course, that can backfire on you too. Just ask the Knicks, because that was the whole purpose of their part of the Porzingis trade, was dumping Tim Hardaway Jr.'s contract and whoever else in that deal, Courtney Lee, because they thought they were getting Durant and Kyrie, and it backfired. Even tampering is not foolproof. So I don't know where that goes either. And you're right, a fascinating case study, which we'll have to leave for another day down the road. Real quick, because this is now a puzzle that they have to solve. And they have a new GM, Nico Harrison, who came from Nike, who never had run a basketball team or been an assistant GM or anything else. I am always skeptical. It doesn't matter how much I like or respect somebody in their other walk of life. When you're hiring a former agent, when you're hiring a shoe company guy, whatever it is, like, I think that's incredibly risky. It's bold, and Cuban is nothing if not bold, but we have no idea at the moment they hire Nico Harrison what kind of GM he might be, and there's a heavy responsibility coming with inheriting a team with Luka Doncic on it, and all of the difficulties that we just laid out with regard to the cap and Porzingis. So real quick, because I don't want to keep you too much longer here with the game tonight, what do we have any feel for what Nico's philosophy is, and how he might try to tackle this puzzle?
I don't think we do yet, to be honest. I am working on something longer and larger about him, and hope to try to answer some of these questions. I think that in terms of, like you mentioned, like, you're skeptical even of agent hires. And we've seen Leon Rose and we've seen Rob Pelinka. Agents at least directly interface with front offices. This is different than even that, you know.
Right, and are versed in all the cap stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's a whole other different skill set that's different than a Nike guy who's well-networked, but isn't a basketball guy or a cap guy or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
Go on.
Yeah. I think that's exactly spot on. I think that there are a lot of transferable skills that Nico used and developed at Nike that will and can and should serve him well in this general manager role. But I think it's also something it's going to take him. You know, like, I still think he's absolutely in a learning process, and he's still, you know, kind of getting a feel of what this job actually is. And I think that's something that will continue to take time. And, you know, it is good that they have a Michael Finley in the front office, and it is good that, you know, well, it's good or bad, but clearly Mark Cuban has has outsized influence as he always had over this franchise. So, you know, it's not purely or solely on Nico Harrison to come up with every idea you know, a lot of his role is communication with Cuban and what he's thinking as well. But I think it's a fascinating question. I don't think we know yet. You know, like, I think your questions are good, and I think they're important. I think they're things that we should be thinking about. And, you know, he's, you know, Nico's given a few interviews here and there, and we've heard some ideas, but in terms of, like, really tangible ideas about what he thinks about a team, about what, you know, what he views this future is. And, you know, just like we were talking about, like, what their options are going forwards. I think we're still a little bit in the dark, which doesn't mean that they're in the dark. They could have very clear plans. He could be fully adjusted by now, or 90% of the way there. I don't know, but I think that we as media members and fans of the Mavericks who are curious, I think that there's still very much trying to understand exactly what Nico is going to look like or how he's adapting to this role. And I think it'll be fascinating to find out.
No doubt. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this before you go. Bob Vulgaris, of course, did the interview with Pablo Torre on Pablo's ESPN podcast last week, and it was a really fascinating discussion. And of course, he did rebut or deny several things that you and Sam had reported in your deep dive several months ago. I don't know if you guys have responded to that yet, so I apologize for just springing it on you at the last minute of our chat. But anything that stood out to you, or anything you want to rebut in his rebuttal?
Yeah, I'd say the long reply is a podcast me and Sam did on the Athletic NBA show. So if you want a full answer, that go check that out. That's the tampering pod. I don't know. We got a bunch of pods under
the names of your
umbrella.
Pods change, and then I can't keep track. And yeah, but the Athletic, bunch of great NBA pods. Yeah. Go find the one with Sam and Tim talking about this.
I'll give you a short answer. The short answer is that I think it's clear, and I've been open and honest about this. It was not what we set out to do, but in the piece that me and Sam wrote, when there is perspective included, it does trend a bit towards Donnie Nelson's perspective and the everything around Donnie Nelson. I think that's clear. I think that's also the...
That's I love the loud. Fact that the sirens are in the background of your home in Dallas.
Impeccable
and not mine
timing.
In Brooklyn. The sirens are almost always coming through my neighborhood, not my guests.
That was an incredibly aggressive one too. I've never that was like three trucks down there. Clearly I shouldn't be talking about this. The feds are coming. So I think the story that was written, look, I what is something I've said this publicly, like, what was remarkable is, like, I really couldn't find people to defend Bob. And I think what he did on the ESPN Pablo, the ESPN podcast with Pablo, was share his version of the events, his perspective. And I would say that there's maybe one or two factual things in there that he disputes. But I think if you really listen to the podcast and really read the piece that me and Sam wrote, and maybe, you know, throw on a couple podcast appearances I did immediately following that, I think that what Bob says in that podcast and what we wrote and said following the story can absolutely mesh. And they do.
Oh, yes.
Like, that's his perspective, and he saw things differently. But he's not disputing facts that we've reported throughout that story. He's disputing perspective that was shared from,
yes,
you know, that largely did come from another side, because, you know, and, you know, this story had nothing to do with, you know, it's amazing. People are like, oh, Donnie Nelson was the source, or like, he's the guy who pushed for this to happen. Or, you know, the moment he learned he was fired, he, you know, just called us up. Yeah. I mean, this is a 4-month thing that, you know, that we spent a lot of time reporting and working on. And so, you know, I would have loved to put more of Bob's perspective. I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was really interesting to fully hear him share his side and his perspective. And I think the last thing I'll end with is that if you really listen to that podcast that he did and you read the piece, I think the main conclusion you come to on both of them is that all of these issues stem from Mark Cuban, the way he instituted Bob's role, and just more broadly about the way he was running that organization. And I think that is a piece and a thing that both me and Bob fully agree on. Both of the pieces of media we did fully agree with. And I think that's just where a lot of the stuff has come from over the past decades of the Mavericks being under governorship or ownership of Mark Cuban. So to me, that's the main takeaway. That was the main takeaway when I published the story, although I understand that, you know, the way it was headlined and, you know, the juiciest details were about this, you know, shadow GM guy and you know, wasn't my phrasing, but, you know, the shadow GM guy and the crypto gambler or whatever. But to me, that was always the takeaway of the story, even when it published. And I think that Bob's perspective on the events that happened only continue to kind of enhance and support that.
I agree. The broad outline of what you guys wrote, more than just the broad outline, a lot of the details absolutely mesh with what Bob said. He just didn't like certain portrayals or interpretations, which of course were based on other people that you guys talked to. And actually, if you were to overlay the two things, your story and Bob's interview, and merge them, you would have a narrative that is fairly consistent all the way through of what was what was wrong with the Mavericks as an organization. Not about who's to blame necessarily, but just you can see the dysfunction coming through in both your reporting and in what Bob told Pablo last week. And it all meshes together. And then somewhere in there, there would be, if he had given that interview to you guys a few months ago, it would have just been, and he disagrees on these couple of points. There would have been a couple of quotes saying, no, I don't think I was cause of this, or I wasn't that. But it doesn't change the facts on the ground. It doesn't change the conditions of what the Mavericks as an organization were at that moment. So no, kudos to you and Sam for what was a fantastic story. But Bob's interview was really fascinating. Maybe he should have spoken at length to you guys a few months ago instead. but anyway, great stuff, Tim. The Mavericks will continue to be interesting as hell the whole season. I have no doubt in my mind. I can't wait to see what the leadership council decides next. I hope it has to do with, you know, upgraded food in media dining at the Mavericks arena, or at least something that benefits us directly. Although the mere existence of the leadership council, I think, benefits us directly. Appreciate your time.
I just want to know, Luca cares about the media. Is that too much to ask? You know, like, throw some,
you know,
man.
Small things. Okay. Thanks again, Tim. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Tim Cato. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. And thank you all, of course, for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to The Crossover wherever you get your podcasts. Go subscribe to the Sports Illustrated Podcasts channel on YouTube. And hit me with all your feedback on Twitter @HowardBeck.